From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen. Terry Gross is on vacation. On today's Fresh Air, using a vivid imagination to get through life during the Depression, we talk with writer A.E. Hotchner about his childhood. To fight off hunger, he would chew on magazine pictures of pot roasts and corn on the cob. Hotchner's memoir, King of the Hill, is now a new film. Hotchner will also tell us about his friendship with Ernest Hemingway. Also, the man Florida's tourism industry hates. We talk with novelist and columnist Carl Hiaasen. He satirizes real estate developers, tourists, and shady politicians in his comic thriller set in South Florida. His latest is Striptease. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Girl Who Trod on a Loaf by Catherine Davis. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. Two former Detroit police officers have been found guilty of murder and the beating death of a black motorist. Phil Denieri reports from Detroit.
Two officers, Walter Budson and Larry Nevers, were charged with beating Malice Green to death with their heavy police flashlights last November. Prosecutors and witnesses say the officers beat Green after he refused to open his clenched hand outside a Detroit crack house. By finding the men guilty of second-degree murder, the jurors decided that there was no provocation for the officers' action. Former officer Walter Budson's attorney, Michael Batchelor, says he will look at a possible appeal.
My client has always maintained that what he was doing was his job, that he did nothing outside of the scope of his employment, that he did not beat, he did not hit, he tried to make an arrest.
Both officers could be sentenced to life in prison. A third officer charged with assault in Green's death had asked for a bench trial and was acquitted by the judge. For National Public Radio, this is Phil Denieri in Detroit.
Bosnian Croats today agreed to UN demands and promised to allow aid this week to reach tens of thousands of Muslims trapped in Mostar. UN peacekeepers who reached the Muslim area Saturday said residents are on the verge of starvation and hospital conditions are desperate. Stephen Walker today became the fourth State Department official in a year to quit his job over U.S. policy in Bosnia. In his resignation letter, Walker, a specialist on Eastern Europe, reportedly told Secretary of State Warren Christopher that he could no longer accept U.S. support for what he called genocide and aggression in Bosnia. Thousands of documents related to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy were made public today by the National Archives in Washington. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
The previously unreleased material, which includes 90,000 pages from the CIA, is being made public under a law passed last October. In the wake of publicity surrounding the movie JFK, Congress ordered all government agencies holding relevant documents to release them unless the papers would endanger national security. The law also orders the president to set up a civilian review panel to pass final judgment on any documents an agency wants to withhold. But President Clinton is long overdue in appointing the panel. Consequently, today's release represents only a small portion of what may be released in coming months or years. Some experts on the assassination predicted today that no smoking guns will be found in the new material, but the Associated Press has found a memo written by a CIA agent 5 days after Kennedy's death, which theorizes that assassin Lee Harvey Oswald was working for the Soviet Union. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
Delta Airlines today offered a voluntary early retirement program to about 3,000 employees in an effort to cut costs and improve its profit picture. The Atlanta-based company said early retirement will be offered to employees in selected departments. And IBM today announced the retirement of its manufacturing vice president, Heinz Friedrich. Friedrich is scheduled to step down at the end of the month. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 9.5 points to close at 3605.98. This is NPR News. Secretary of Defense Les Aspin today outlined dangers facing the United States in the post-Cold War era. The secretary says his department has responded to these threats through a national security strategy, which will be released next month. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
Secretary Aspin says in preparing the department's bottom-up review, focus was placed on four areas of potential threat: regional conflicts, the proliferation of nuclear weapons, threat to American economic strength, and the failure of democratic reform in the former Soviet Union. In his Dallas speech before the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the secretary said the U.S. does not require the defense it did during the Cold War, but the U.S. still has to be ready.
Iraq's invasion of Kuwait made one thing very clear. The end of the Cold War does not mean the end of the need for defense. The world is still a dangerous place. and we still have to defend America.
Aspen gave no specifics about the changes he expects when the bottom-up review is complete. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
The Justice Department said today United Technologies Corporation has agreed to pay more than $5 million in fines to settle a lawsuit accusing the company of violating environmental pollution laws. The violations occurred at 10 facilities in Connecticut in 1990 and 1991. Caterpillar Corporation said today it began shipping about $100 million worth of tractors to a Russian natural gas company. It's the largest single sale of any type Caterpillar product to the CIS since its embargo on sales to the former Soviet Union was lifted in 1983. The Russian firm will use the tractors to explore and build pipeline and gas fields in Siberia. Masked gunmen in Bayonne, France today made off with more than $1.5 million after forcing an armored car driver to open his offices. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. It's hard to imagine that A.E. Hotchner, living hand-to-mouth as a kid in transient hotels during the Depression, would grow up to become friends with such celebrities as Ernest Hemingway, Paul Newman, Gary Cooper, Dorothy Parker, and Marlene Dietrich. But he did. After serving in the Air Force during the Second World War, he wrote for Cosmopolitan magazine, where it was his job to profile the famous people of the day. It was the beginning of a writing career that got him close to well-known literary and Hollywood figures, people like Clark Gable, J.D. Salinger, Tennessee Williams, Ingrid Bergman, to name a few. He also wrote biographies of Sophia Loren, Doris Day, and his book about Hemingway, called Papa Hemingway, was a bestseller. But it is the book he wrote 20 years ago about himself and his family's struggle during the Depression that is the subject of a new film called King of the Hill, directed by Steven Soderbergh. The film is set in the rundown St. Louis Hotel where Hotchner and his family lived and where he spent nearly 2 months alone when he was 12. Hotchner told me that, like many families in the 30s, his family was hit hard by the Depression. I asked him what his life was like before.
Well, we were a very solid middle-class family. My father had a fur business. St. Louis was a fur hub. He was doing fairly well. We lived comfortably. We were pretty much toward the middle of the families of St. Louis. He had all of his money in one bank, the Night and Day Bank, which went under. There was no deposit insurance in those days. And I think he got paid one penny on a dollar, and that destroyed any fabric he had in the business world. And from then on, it was a spiral downhill. The net result of it was that we had to leave where we were living. We went into progressively less attractive places. And in the summer of 1933, which is when the book delineates my life, and that's what the movie's about, we had wound up in a really seedy hotel in a bad section of St. Louis, a hotel that had a taxi dance hall in the basement, prostitutes on the first floor who worked the dance hall. It was a real flea bag of a hotel.
How did your parents' worries, anxieties about making money and about their future affect you as a kid?
Well, I think you realized, not only because of your parents' anxieties, but because of the anxieties on the streets and what had happened to everybody around you, that you were in a calamitous situation. But what I think is not realized is that what is insurmountable for an adult, they look at a world in which things are in smoking ruins, in which people aren't eating, in which there seems to be no hope for getting a job, they look at it differently than a 12-year-old boy who always sees some kind of a possibility of getting around whatever the obstacle is. At least that was my attitude.
Well, you seem to be a very resourceful young boy. I was wondering whether your parents had raised you to be that way or whether there was something about the circumstances that really forced you to be so grown up and to be so resourceful.
I think it's the circumstance. As a matter of fact, my family were very conservative. They didn't take risks. My father was a European. My mother had been born in this country, but into a family of immigrants. So these were conservative people who didn't take risks and who tried to abide by, very orderly, by the laws and the rules, so that whatever I did in the way of inventing a life for myself, and whatever imagination motivated me, and whatever motivated that world that I created for myself, had to be something that was peculiar to me. I can't believe that we had any of those elements in the house at the time.
Your imagination was really your key to survival. You were able to spin out an imaginary life for yourself.
One thing was, I even had an overall pretense in my mind, and I really accepted it, that my parents were really wealthy, and that this was just a momentary lapse during which they wanted me to see how it was to live poor, and that at any moment they would say, okay, Aaron, that's enough. Now we can go live in our real house, which is out there in the suburbs, and it's terrific, and you've got a big backyard with a basketball hoop. So I just persisted in that delusion, and it really did stand me in very good stead. I had a lot of other delusions, but that was the main one.
What does it take to believe a delusion like that when your world is so clearly a very harsh world, and the world of your imagination is so lush in comparison?
Well, one motivating factor, I think, was the fact that I read prodigious amounts of books, and the books were all books of fantasy, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and all the rest of the books. I particularly like French authors. So I sort of dwelt in a world of imagination anyway in these books. I think that I just bridged whatever I was reading into the life I was leading, and I could very often pretend that I was something that I wasn't. I could walk down the street and decide that I was really D'Artagnan, one of the musketeers. I'd have an old piece of hickory twig, and that was my sword. So the pretense and the imagination and the make-believe is what gets you over the fact that you haven't eaten in a day and a half, and that you're hungry, and that your clothes are wearing through and your kids are all busted up. But nevertheless, you pretend that it's a world that is satisfactory to you, that you're really part of something else.
Well, I want to play a clip from the movie, but let me first just describe what's happened to you as we get to this part of the movie. Your mother is sick. She's taken to a sanitarium. Your brother has been sent away to live with relatives because your parents couldn't afford for him to live with you. Your father is leaving to sell watches, and this is finally a job where he believes he can actually make some money. But you are left alone at the age of 12. And let me just play this clip.
Listen to me, Aaron. You're going to be okay. You're a smart boy. You're very smart. I tell you how smart you are. Once when you were less than a year old, your mother was in a sanitarium with consumption, and you would cry every night. So the first few times I picked you up and you stopped crying, so I realized you just wanted attention. So the next time you cried, I got a glass of cold water, and I stood over the crib, and I said, you see this? This is a glass of cold water, so you better stop crying or you'll be sorry. But you kept crying, so I poured the cold water in your face, and you stopped crying just like that. And from then on, when you cried, all I had to do was to show you the glass of water, and you'd stop crying. Now, that's a smart baby for you, eh?
Did your father say that to you?
More than once, all through my boyhood, when people would come to visit, my father would trot out that story about how smart I was, that all he had to do was show me that glass of ice water, and that I would stop talking and stop crying. It, you know, it's his variation on Pavlov's dog.
Right.
And I think that that story and others of my father, his insensitivity to the problems I would have, leaving me alone and giving me 25 cents or 50 cents and a kind of a promise that the guy at the cafeteria was going to give me some food, I think that ruptured any possible relationship I could have with my father after that. And I never did. But that story certainly was authentic. It was word for word the way he used to tell it, and he repeated it many times.
Let me ask you how you were able to survive on your own. Here you were, all by yourself, at the age of 12. Your father was off working. Your mother is in the sanitarium.
First of all, what did you do for money? You were only given, 25, 50 cents by your dad.
Well, I did nothing that would earn any money because there was no job. I mean, there were grown men all over the street who would do anything for 25 cents. They would work for a whole day for it. So it was impossible to earn any money. But I could walk to school. I had, with the 25 cents he left me, had been able to buy some food. Unlike the movie, the fact is that the man was there in the restaurant for a while until he left. So I got a few meals. And then at lunchtime at school, I as it's depicted in the movie, I would watch the fat, plump, rich kids with their full pail of food, lunch pail. And when they would go away and run around the lunchroom a little bit, I would go over and filch a sandwich or two, and that sustained me. But as for money, that didn't exist. I just had to get along without it.
The movie ends, your memoir ends, your family is reunited. Fill us in, if you can, what happened after that? And your father actually was able to get a job.
Well, I wish that it had it all become a happy ending, because that's how it looked at the time that the book ends and as the movie ends. But reality, alas, is not the same as fiction. What happened was, my father really wasn't qualified for that job at the WPA, and it didn't last very long. So we were out of the decent apartment that we had and into a succession of grubby places that we had to go live, one worse than the other. There was one room that was next to a station that had fire engines, and they went out all times of the day and night, and it sounded like they were coming right through the room that we were sleeping in. We really had a rather difficult time of it, right up to the time that I went to college. I finally got scholarships and scrounged my way and got a little job and got myself to Washington University. But it was never a very rewarding life until I finally got out of university and practiced law for a couple of years before I went into the Air Force. But it was a long haul, this struggle.
We just have to take a short break. My guest is writer A.E. Hotchner, and filmmaker Steven Soderbergh has made a movie about my guest's childhood. The movie is called King of the Hill, and it's based on my guest's memoir of the same name. A.E. Hotchner is known for his biographies, including the bestseller Papa Hemingway. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer A.E. Hotchner. Let's make a leap in time if we can. And certainly you've made a name for yourself as someone who's written a number of biographies, including the biography of Sophia Loren, Doris Day, Ernest Hemingway. How did you become interested in the lives of these famous people?
Well, it wasn't anything that I had planned or was deliberate. When I finally got out of the Air Force, I decided to stay in Paris. I had wound up on Air Force Magazine as a major and running their bureau and having a fine time, so I got discharged. By the time I got back, there were no jobs left. And a friend of mine had become editor of Cosmopolitan. It was then a literary magazine before Helen Gurley Brown brought in Sex and the Single Girl. The only job he had for me was to become what I would think of as a literary bounty hunter. He gave me a list of 20 writers who had once written for the magazine, but weren't writing for them anymore. He paid my expenses to go see them, and if I got them to write something, I was paid a fee. That was the bounty. Mm. So in that way, I got to meet Edna Ferber and Dorothy Parker and became great friends with them over the years. And other people, Steinbeck. The last on the list, and I tried to avoid, was Hemingway. But he forced me to go down to Havana And as I recount in Papa Hemingway, I sent him a note just saying, "Dear Mr. Hemingway, I'm down here on this ridiculous assignment. If you just send me a note saying, go fly a kite, then I can go back and say, look, I tried to get him." Instead, he called me and said, "Come on, have a drink at the Floridita." And he did, and the drink lasted about 4 hours. And the next day, he took me out in the boat, and I became really a pal of his as a result of that initial visit.
What do you think he saw in you?
I think he saw in me the son that he didn't have with the three sons he had. Now, that might sound a little bit strange, but at the time that I went down to Cuba, I was young, I was just out of the Air Force. He never really connected with the three sons he has. It may be that because of the divorces, they were with their mother. I don't know why. He always had problems with them. With me, he had none of those. I was sort of born afresh with him. So he took great pleasure in teaching me things. And I, God knows, didn't know anything. So I was a perfect receiver for that. So he taught me how to deep sea fish, how to shoot game in Idaho, how to understand and appreciate the bullfight. He even, taking it to a terrible extreme, on one occasion maneuvered me to go into the ring with the two greatest bullfighters in the world, Domenguin and Antonio Ordonez.
How'd you do?
I survived. I mean, that was as harrowing as life gets. But all of those things, I think another factor was that, as I told you, I lived this unreal kind of existence. So I saw soon after I had contacted him, and I went to Paris with him because he was finishing the book that he was writing for himself, but Cosmopolitan was going to publish it. I said to myself, "Now this is a fine life. Look at that. He doesn't work for anybody. He just goes where he wants to go. He writes a little bit." And I immediately resigned my job. It didn't occur to me, having only about $180 in the bank, that it wouldn't quite be as easy for me to get along as it was for Ernest Hemingway. But as it was life in the hotel, it just never seemed to me an obstacle. So I immediately set about trying to get assignments for magazines, and I got a couple and built on that. That made me available to go anywhere that he wanted to go. I had no job. I had nothing that I had to punch a clock for. So when Ernest said, "Why don't you come out to catch him and we'll shoot some pheasant," I went. When he said, "Why don't you, I've had a terrible crash in Africa and I've come back to Venice in Europe and Amsterdam." And I was doing an article about a soothsayer that the Queen of Holland was using to guide her affairs. He said, "Why don't you come down to Venice and we'll drive to Madrid together and we'll talk about things." So I was available. So that's really part of it too.
Did he read your writing?
Yes, he did. And he also saw every one of the television adaptations that I made. At first I said, "Would you like to see the scripts after I do them?" We did talk about the background. He said, "Nope, I don't want to see any scripts. I'll look at the shows, and if they're good, that's fine." I said, "What if they're not?" He said, "That's not fine." So thank goodness he never really objected. But on one trip that we took, I was driving Ernest and Mary along with them. I was doing the driving from Ketchum. We were going to Key West, and he knew that the first part of For Whom the Bell Tolls, which I had done for Playhouse 90, there were 2 hour-and-a-half segments. It was going to be on television, and I was hoping he would forget it, but he remembered, and we went into a motel in Arizona, I believe, somewhere. Some little out-of-the-way place, and they only had one big television set in the lobby, and it had rabbit ears on it. So Hemingway had it brought up to his room, and we tuned it in. Well, the only way the set would work would be if somebody held one of the rabbit ears. For some reason, human contact made the picture come in. So he said, "Well, look, Hotch, you've seen this. You know about it. You made it. Why don't you just sit there beside the set and hold the rabbit ear, and Mary and I'll get up here on the bed, and we'll watch it." And that's as sweaty as I ever got, with him watching For Whom the Bell Tolls while I sat there holding the rabbit ear.
And watching him, watching what you'd done.
That's what I looked at. I couldn't see the screen.
What did he teach you about drinking?
He taught me to drink. The first time I met him, he called a hotel. I was staying at the Nacional. And the phone rang, and this voice says, "Hotchner, Hemingway here." He said, got your note about how if I don't answer you, they might fire you. And he said, you're working for Hearst? He said, God, working for Hearst? I mean, if he got fired there, it'd be like getting kicked out of a leper colony. He said, come meet me, have a drink at the Floridita. So that was how I met him, at the Floridita. And he was drinking a concoction called a Papa Doble. It was a daiquiri that was served in a vase that could have held long-stem roses. So I drank it. It was a very pleasant drink. I had never drunk much, maybe not at all at that point. And it was a very fine-tasting concoction, lime juice and something else in there. And we got onto the second one, and I handled that all right. But after that, I don't have much memory of the rest of that evening. But from then on, Hemingway was a very tolerant fellow about drinking. He didn't say, drink up and let's have another drink ever. He drank at his pace and you drank at yours. But one thing that I really found difficult, when we go out in the boat, it'd be 6 o'clock in the morning, and he'd go up on the top deck where he had a set of controls that he used for steering the boat. Underneath it was an ice box that you sat on. So he would open it up, take out a ice-encrusted bottle of tequila, and pour you 3 fingers of that, put a little salt on our hands, and Donna would go, that was pretty tough in the morning. But that's just part of the ritual, and I got to enjoy it, but I never really drank very much, and he didn't really make made no demands. He sometimes would like to drink Pernod, which is a polite form of absinthe, and I would have a beer, and that was fine. It was never imposed.
You describe your very close relationship with Ernest Hemingway and the fact that you really looked up to him the whole time that you knew him. What is it like to try to write a biography about someone who you admire so much?
It wasn't a biography. It was a memoir. I only wrote about those years that I knew him. It's a very personal account of what we did and where we went and what he had to say. About his, a good deal of it's about his past. So in that sense, it's a biography. Ernest was a marvelous raconteur. He spoke as well as he wrote. So very often we'd be in Paris, and I remember one occasion we walked up to Montmartre. We walked around Montmartre, and he began to reminisce about that place or this place and what happened there. He would be reminded, we passed a place, he said, oh, down there in the basement was Le Jockey, the best nightclub I was ever in, and that's where I met whoever. I think he told me he first saw Fitzgerald there. I know who it was. It was Josephine Baker. That one of the times he was there, there was this tall, wildly attractive woman. It was July, a real heat wave in Paris, and she was dancing in a fur coat with a British subaltern, and he was absolutely fascinated, this gorgeous woman, so he cut in, and that was the beginning of his, the years of his relationship with Josephine Baker. So, I mean, in the course of being with him, I was told about the past and told about the present and told about people and told about bullfighters and had a wonderful running commentary on life.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today and talking to us about your life.
It was fine visiting with you.
Writer A.E. Hotchner, his memoir King of the Hill is the basis for a new movie by Steven Soderbergh. Hotchner's best-selling biography of Hemingway is called Papa Hemingway. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Coming up, sleaze in South Florida. We talk with novelist and columnist Carl Hiaasen about his fifth comic thriller, Striptease, featuring the lovesick for a stripper Congressman David Dilbeck and the Eager Beaver Club, where the latest attraction is a vat of cream corn where patrons wrestle with the strippers. There's murder, blackmail, and a corrupt sugar industry, too. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Girl Who Trod on a Loaf, the new novel by Catherine Davis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Detroit, two former police officers charged in the beating death of motorist Malice Green last November have been found guilty of second-degree murder. Don Gagne reports.
The convicted officers are Larry Nevers and Walter Budson. Prosecutors argued that the two partners struck Malice Green repeatedly in the head with their police flashlights. An autopsy said any one of those blows could have killed Green. A third officer, Robert Lesnow, had been charged with assault, but the judge ruled that there was not enough evidence for a conviction in the case against Lesnow. Nevers and Budson now face possible life prison sentences. Reaction on the streets of Detroit was positive. At the corner of 23rd and Warren, that's the site of Malice Green's death, about 70 people gathered and watched the verdict come in on a portable television. As the two convictions were announced, they let out a cheer, some saying they were surprised that the justice system actually worked in the case of white police officers charged in the beating death of an unemployed black man. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
For the first time in nearly 2 months, barges are moving on the Mississippi River again. Well, the U.S. Coast Guard has opened the river to commercial traffic for more than 800 miles, there are still some restrictions. Officials say that barge traffic in the wake of record flooding is slow and controlled. For north of St. Louis, there is a ban on more than 15 barges for each tow. From St. Louis south, there is one-way traffic on the river in some places. It's estimated that barges have been losing an estimated $3 million every day because of the flooding. In South Africa, a special commission has charged that officials currently serving in the African National Congress were guilty of human rights abuses at ANC military camps operating in the 1970s and 1980s. The commission recommended that the ANC compensate victims. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
Other investigations have documented torture and beatings of detainees suspected of being spies in the ANC exile camps. But today's report by an independent commission is the first to name those responsible, including two members of the group's National Executive Committee and several officials in the ANC Security Department. The commission said the ANC should apologize to those who were abused and punish those responsible for the violations. ANC officials said the group's executive committee would meet this weekend to consider the recommendations, including the possible suspension or expulsion of those named as human rights violators. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 9.5 points to close at 3,605.98 on volume of more than 210 million shares. Declining issues led advances by a slight margin. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, UN officials say Croatian forces are still blocking aid convoys from getting to some 55,000 people trapped in Mostar. Officials say very little progress has been made in making sure that some 130 tons of supplies get to Muslim residents of the city. Over the weekend, a small amount of aid got through to a hospital where patients are being treated without electricity or running water. Officials say that those trapped in the city will start dying of starvation in the next few days if supplies don't get to the southern Bosnian town. Croatian forces want some of their wounded to be taken out of a hospital in central Bosnia before allowing UN forces into eastern Mostar. UN officials have turned down any link between the two. Another Foreign Service officer has resigned, citing policy toward Bosnia as the reason. Stephen Walker charged that the U.S. is putting up with genocide and aggression. Barry Schweid reports.
It was the third resignation this month, a clear sign of growing impatience and even alarm over a policy that threatens the Serbs with force, but uses economic sanctions and diplomacy and a mostly unsuccessful strategy to curb the Serbs. It's the biggest rebellion since Vietnam, when several National Security Council staffers quit to protest the U.S. bombing of Cambodia. Ironically, it comes at a time when Secretary of State Warren Christopher is trying to rally the NATO allies to use force against the Serbs if they maintain their siege of remaining Muslim enclaves. Christopher has met with groups of dissidents, received memos from them, and tried to assure them the administration is trying its best to cope with a frustrating situation. The three resignations this month suggest he may be losing that argument. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
In trading in Europe, the dollar moved down against the Japanese yen. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Very little of what novelist and journalist Carl Hiaasen has written has endeared him to the Florida Chamber of Commerce. His column for the Miami Herald and his novels deal with what he sees as the corrupt relationship between business and politics in the Sunshine State. Hiaasen is that rare species, a Florida native. And if he had his way, he would drive the tourists from the beaches, rip up the malls, close Disney World, and return the state to the pastoral beauty of his youth. He is quoted as saying air conditioning and mosquito repellent were the ruination of Florida. His latest novel, Striptease, involves a shady politician, David Dilbeck, who's in the pocket of the sugar industry and is a sucker for a naked woman. His current obsession is Erin Grant, a new dancer at the Eager Beaver, an upscale strip club. She works there to raise money to pay a lawyer to regain custody of her child. Since he's also a journalist, Hiaasen said finding a model for the corrupt Congressman Dilbeck was easy.
You could almost, fire a dart gun in the halls of Congress and in anyone who might fit the category. But I mean, the actual event, the opening of the book, for example, which takes place in one of these new so-called upscale adult clubs in Fort Lauderdale, where the congressman behaves rather badly and draws a lot of attention to himself. And that was inspired by an actual incident in which my own congressman in 1978 was a six-term Republican congressman from Broward County, Florida, was arrested in a strip joint at about 2 in the morning on all sorts of problem charges that had to do with his behavior relating to the women and the other customers. And it was pretty much the end of his political career. And it always stuck with me that here was a guy whose job was pretty much a cinch, and he kept getting reelected, you know, every 2 years. What compelled him to do that sort of thing, to risk it all just to go in there for some cheap thrills? And so, you know, that sort of stuck with me, and that launched the book, but there are many other models and inspirations for what happens after that.
Well, what kind of research did you do for the book?
In terms of the political stuff, it's just obvious it's on the front pages every day. In terms of writing about, for instance, the sugar industry, Big Sugar, I do that on a regular basis in my column, and it certainly we covered well in the Miami Herald. So, I mean, that was right at my fingertips, as it were. The other research about the clubs, I had to pop in here and there. And I, as I said, less than you would think. I mean, my main interest was in talking to some of the performers who, especially the women who were single mothers with kids, because that's the hero of the book. The heroine of the book is a single mother with a child. And I wanted to find out what the kind of struggles you have trying to have a job like that and raise a kid by yourself at the same time. So they were great conversations and they were great interviews. The only trouble was that they would be interrupted about every 3.5 minutes when they just get up spontaneously and begin dancing and throwing lingerie around, and it's distracting. And it's somewhat hard to keep your, not only your train of thought, but I mean, and they're very nonchalant about it to them because it's just business. But when you're sitting there having, you know, what you think is a very quiet, subdued conversation, and this one dancer was showing me pictures of her daughter and school and everything, and the next second they're sort of up on the table doing what they do, it was tough to interview under those circumstances.
Well, the women in your novel, or the women that work at this strip joint, have really more class, more daring, more smarts than most of the other characters in the book. Did you find that to be true?
Absolutely. I mean, the men in the customers in these joints are the suckers. I mean, men are suckers anyway, but I mean, the show, when I went into these places, it was, believe it or not, it became much more interesting to watch the behavior of the men than it was the dancers, because the dancers were I mean, it's a very cold-blooded sort of mission, and that is to separate you from your money, because that's what they do for a living. I mean, they dance, and you give them a tip, and that's how they make their money. But and they're very smart and cunning about it. The men, however, especially after a couple of drinks, are just total, you know, they fall hopelessly in love with whatever pair of legs is on the table at the time.
Empty. Because they think she's doing it for him.
Oh, right? They think that they've just charmed her into just disrobing on a moment's notice. You know, when in fact she's actually thinking about, gee, I got to go to the laundromat after work. They think she's thinking about them and what a handsome, dashing guy. They would tell me their tricks. It was really interesting. They would say, well, the way we usually work it, if you muss up their hair a little bit, the customer they're talking about, or if they're wearing a necktie, you adjust their necktie a little bit, and you've got them. They're hooked. They'll sit there all evening, and they'll give you every bit of cash they got, and it's absolutely true. I mean, I watched it. It was amazing, and the guys are just predictable like that. We're just total saps, and, you know, I don't know whether it's ego or alcohol or that deadly combination of both of them. Then at the end of the evening, of course, the girls vanish. And they can't, the guys are all sitting, well, where did she go? Well, you're out of money, pal. She's gone.
Well, there's a phrase called schmoeing out.
Now, I've heard that. That isn't in the book, but I mean, that I've heard that phrase used in the jargon in these clubs. And that is when a guy just sort of totally goes gaga over a particular dancer, and she dances pretty much until he's out of money. And now, though, some of the clubs in Lauderdale have installed cash machines, which is really deadly. Not only can you spend your whole paycheck on a Friday night, you can go and on credit, you know, completely bankrupt your entire family for the sake of one evening of dancing. So they've got these cash machines you go to now. So it's really amazing. It's an amazing enterprise. And it's, like I said, it's proliferated to the point. The club owner in Lauderdale also owns quite a number of clubs in Manhattan and in Dallas and other places. I mean, and he's a multimillionaire. He probably has 60 clubs going around the country right now. So this is sort of a new thing, the idea of going in a coat and tie and it being a very respectable place where no hanky-panky at all goes on. I mean, the place is crawling with guys with no necks who just would love to remove you at a moment's notice. So there's nothing untoward happening except, guys are sitting there sort of parting with their money.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a very short break. My guest is Carl Hiaasen. He's an investigative journalist and columnist for the Miami Herald. He's also the author of a number of novels, and his latest one, they all take place in Florida, is called Striptease. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Carl Hiaasen is my guest. How much money could a woman make on a typical night?
One night, a dancer that I talked to, the night I was there, she made $1,500.
Cash?
Cash, yeah. And that's a good night. Most of them make between $2,500 and $3,500 a week.
Do they do it for the money, or do they also get off on the power of kind of taunting
both
men in the audience?
Yeah. Both. I mean, because it is a tease after all, but there's certainly an element of control. I'm not sure powers are, but they're in control and they know it. So, and there's a little bit of a thrill to be the center of attention. Some of them were very frank about that when they talked to me, because it was very safe. Nobody laid a hand on you, except of course in the friction dancing joints. Then it wasn't the customer, it was the dancer, again, who sort of dictated the terms of that little enterprise. But by and large, they were in it for the money. And most of them, and I had several of them say to me, look, you know, how long can I do this? Maybe 2-3 years? I can put a lot of money in the bank. I can put my kid in private school. I can pay off my car. Many of them were in college. I had one, and I'm very seriously, who had already applied to the FBI Academy, and she was dancing that night I was there. And there are no stereotypes that go along with this. There are just a lot of different reasons why they were there. Oddly enough, I think I only met one who honestly believed that she was going to be discovered, that some movie director was going to walk in and spot her, and then she was going to be whisked off to Hollywood. I talked to quite a number of the dancers, and I really only, it was a very young woman who was maybe 18, 19 years old, and who really thought that this was her ticket to stardom. Most of them were much much smarter than that, and they know what it was all about. It was a business enterprise.
You feel comfortable in places like
no,
this?
No,
not at all.
No, not really. And it gets tedious and boring after a while. It honestly does. I mean, I don't know how to describe it. There's a character in the book, the bouncer in the book, or I should say, the floor manager. They don't like to be called bouncers. Shad is his name, and his problem is he's been in the business 11 years, and he is totally numb to the sight of. It's the sight of the most gorgeous woman. I mean, does anything for him now, except the only thing that excites him is the sight of women with clothes on, because he's been working in nude joints for 11 years, and he's had it. He's trying to get out because he realizes he's just been almost bored to tears by the whole thing. And that is something I drew from talking to people who work there and from sort of watching the faces on some of the guys, the bouncers in these places. I mean, they might as well have been working on a Chrysler assembly liner, or selling automotive parts at Kmart. I mean, they were really, it was like they were in another world because they've been at it so long.
Well, how true was it that there was, or even is, I guess, in the Fort Lauderdale area, a place where there's cream corn wrestling?
That's
such
true.
A thing?
Oh,
such
yeah. It's not. There was. It was a lounge in West Palm Beach. They don't do it anymore. I think there was a problem with the health department. They actually had four kinds of wrestling you could do. And you could wrestle, the big ad that said wrestle nude women, which in and of itself is sort of a strange aspiration, but I mean, I guess enough guys were drunk enough to do it, but you could wrestle them. In the old days, it was like mud wrestling or oil wrestling. Now they've gone into the four major food groups. They had some cream corn, they had dill pickles. You could wrestle in a vat of dill pickles, which is scary. I don't even want to think about that. They had, you could wrestle in chocolate pudding, and my favorite was pasta, because I didn't really specify what kind of pasta, and I thought that was important, that they should have been a little more specific in the advertising. So when the fellow from Vanity Fair was interviewing me, he said, well, I'm going to go find the cream corn wrestling. You want to go with me? And I said, absolutely not. I said, I would rather have dental surgery, if you don't mind, than to go watch two grown people wrestle around in a vat of niblets. I just don't think so. But he intrepidly went to West Palm, and he went to this lounge, and he found the pit closed. And he asked, did you ever have cream corn wrestling? He said, yeah, we're not doing that anymore. But in the back room, apparently, they had pictures all over the walls of cream corn wrestling in its heyday, and it was hugely popular. And he said there was also wrestling, so some dill pickle extravaganzas. So, I mean, I was grateful. He had the good journalistic instincts to go there, but you couldn't have got me up there with an Uzi, because that's not one of my... I would have had nightmares for years about that.
Carl Hyacin is my guest, and he's a journalist with the Miami Herald and also a novelist as well. His latest book is called Striptease. You made a statement a number of years back that didn't exactly endear you to the mayor of Miami.
Which one was that?
Well,
I made a number of statements.
Or various Chamber of Commerce's. You said there's nothing wrong with South Florida that a good Force 5 hurricane couldn't fix. I was wondering when Hurricane Andrew moved across South Florida if you felt responsible.
Well, not at all. I mean, hurricanes are a force of nature. Back in the 40s and 50s, we had one or two a year in South Florida. People don't remember that. And now we go 30 years without a big storm, and everybody's shocked when it comes and it blows everything down. That's because we built these houses with basically chewing gum and toothpicks, and it's no surprise that they fell down. The real crime of all that was the misery that all these people had to suffer because they were sold a bill of goods. And I didn't feel responsible. I mean, it was a matter of time before we got hit by a hurricane, and it was up not to me but to the county and state and other agencies and regulatory agencies to make sure that the houses would stand up, the people would be prepared and evacuated and taken care of afterwards. And a lot of that didn't happen, and I don't feel responsible for that at all. My only thought on that given day was that, and I always, this is sort of a recurring theme of the novels, is that we live in a tropical zone down there, and it's not just hurricanes. There's a lot of wildlife and critters and things. I mean, we sort of kicked a lot of natural things off that land when we went down there and started paving, putting up our hotels and setting up our cabanas. I mean, we displaced a lot of natural elements that continue and occasionally come back to haunt us. And the hurricane is just one of many hazards that's liable to pop up down there. We're just not ready for it. And if we live in a place like Florida, which is in the tropics and subject to these storms, we got to be prepared for a worst-case scenario. And Hurricane Andrew was not a worst-case scenario. It was a was a very centrally located dry hurricane that really breezed through in 4 hours and still virtually destroyed a huge part of the county.
But why are the housing codes so lax?
Well, because you have, as always, the builders and developers in Florida are and always have been the major political force. They do not want strict enforcement. They don't want a building and zoning department that's going to go out and hassle them. They want a building and zoning department that's going to be their friend. The Herald's written numerous stories about not only corruption, but we did stories about people who are supposed to be inspecting roofs in these subdivisions who never even had a ladder on their truck. They would drive by a roof and, looking up out the window of their truck, decided that that was a good roof and it would last during a hurricane. I mean, it's absurd. I mean, it sounds like a Woody Allen scene, and that's exactly what was happening. They'd, like, drive through a neighborhood without ever getting up and without ever, ever climbing on the roof, inspect and approve an entire subdivision. And guess what happened when the storm came? All the roofs blew off of that subdivision.
Well,
who should be surprised by that? So now, a year later, nobody's been indicted. Nobody's been convicted. Nobody's been fired. And the same crew of clowns is out there both building and failing to inspect it again. So the next storm is going to be just as bad or worse.
Well, you certainly are one of the few people born and still living in South Florida. Could you imagine living anywhere else?
Well, I think about it all the time,
but
it's awfully cold. You know, I mean, I think about it. Montana sure looks good, but that's for about 3 months of the year. And then the rest of the time, I mean, when you're born and raised in Florida, you have limited options. I mean, to me, Atlanta is the far north. Moving to Atlanta would be like Admiral Byrd going to the poles. I mean, I just can't imagine it.
What do you do about the humidity, though? I've been in Florida in August, and I thought it was just horrible.
I love it. It's good for you.
How?
It just soaks into your skin and your bones, and it's good for you. Actually, what it's good for is thinning out the population a little bit down there. You see, sort of natural, so it's Darwinism at work.
Well, have you started work on your next novel, and is there anything you can tell us about it?
No, I haven't really. I mean, I've kicked around some ideas. I've been so busy with this one. But I think it'll obviously be a sort of a post-hurricane apocalypse novel. I mean, just the things that have happened since the storm have been both so outrageous and touching and interesting that, I mean, it begs for something. And I think I've got some ideas. I just haven't really cranked up on it yet.
Well, I thank you so much, Carl Hiaasen, for joining us. Journalist and novelist Carl Hiaasen's latest novel is called Striptease. This is Fresh Air. The news is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the stories on All Things Considered today. Robert, what stories will you have for us?
Well, we'll have a story on verdicts in the trial of former Detroit police officers for the beating death of Malice Green. Two convictions. One officer charged with a lesser offense was acquitted in that case. Also today, we'll have news of difficulties in communicating with the Mars Observer, the spacecraft, barges running once again on the Mississippi, the situation in Nicaragua, and a special report by Linda Wertheimer, conversations with young people who are infected with the AIDS virus, that is, they're HIV positive, and what they make of their lives.
Robert, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The kind of Sturm und Drang that make great opera great also figure in the plot of the new novel, The Girl Who Trod on a Loaf. But critic John Leonard says he's impressed by the way author Catherine Davis has discarded many of the other conventions of the art form.
Although it was a folk song and a broadside before Hans Christian Andersen got a hold of it, the basic storyline of The Girl Who Trod on a Loaf remains consistent and punitive. A bad girl, rather than dirty her brand new shoes while crossing the Danish bog, steps instead on the loaf of bread she's supposed to bring to her mother. For this, she's punished by being cast down to the bog's bottom and petrified in the devil's courtyard, where only her eyes can move, and then only backwards to see her evil thoughts. In Catherine Davis's wonderful novel, this nasty tale is what the elderly Danish feminist lesbian composer, Helle Ten Brix, wants to turn into her last opera. Except that in Helle's opera, a loaf of bread is a symbol of oppression, and a shoe is a uterus. But Helle may die of emphysema before she can finish her opera, which is why she removes herself from Europe to upstate New York, where she will first befriend and then possess Frances Thorne. Frances is a conservatory-educated waitress in an airport diner and the mother of bright twin girls. She lives, of course, above a bakery and has been downwardly mobile ever since a shameful violence done to her. Helly leads Frances to wonder, on behalf of all the women who've ever died in all the operas composed by men, if such art is really necessary, and whether you can ever trust a tenor. What happens next in this astonishing novel defies synopsis. We're told that a love of hyperbole is essential to the operatic vision. Who could remember all the details of such complicated stories? Who in their right mind would want to? People jumping in and out of closets, stabbing each other, yodeling. And so it goes in The Girl Who Trod on a Loaf. We get adultery, murder, and demonic possession. But as in the richest of fairy tales, there are also locks and keys, towers and crows, a masked ball and a wicked stepmother, not to mention Norse myth and Freudian psychology and European fascism. Most of all, we get music. So much Mozart, as if the chord of the whole novel were the dominant seventh of the magic flute, on the verge of resolving itself in pure inspiration. But also Puccini, Wagner, Alban Berg, and of course the human voice, called here that most tragic of all instruments, the hopeful human voice, singing, trying to hold a note forever. Each of Helly's operas is described in dazzling detail, including quotes from their rich and witty libretti. And it's not only as if Catherine Davis were another Nabokov, showing off, but also an amazing vindication of feminist theory. None of these operas, rich in an alternative symbolism, could have been written by a man. They partake of an imagination entirely other to the grand tradition of the 19th century stage, and to those ritual spaces of 20th century theater, the crematoria and the gulag. All art, we are told, is about captivity and escape, and no art has ever saved anybody's life, and all artists are monsters. A grim message, maybe, but a brilliant orchestration in a novel as deeply textured, as deftly assured, as haunting, and as harmonious as any I've read in years.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Girl Who Trod on a Loaf by Catherine Davis. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Bob Alls, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Marty Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If death is a part of life, then why in our society is it so hard for us to accept it? Why has death become the enemy? And how does that affect social and medical policy? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with medical ethicist Daniel Callahan. And we talk with actor Jerry Adler, who plays the murderous husband in the new Woody Allen film. I'm Marty Moskowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.